The figure and the teachings of the great Gnostic prophet Mani are today, at least at this particular time, not very prominently represented in literature and other means of publicity. This, however, may change. We are assured by our various scholarly friends in the Institute of Antiquity and Christianity in Clermont and elsewhere, clear to Germany, that a number of important Manichaean writings, some which have been sitting around in primarily East German museums and archives in an untranslated and unpublished form until now, are now gradually about to be published, and many have been translated already, and also some more recent discoveries of Manichaean writings from Egypt will also be made available. So it is quite likely that the next cycle of publications after that of the Najd Hammadi library, which is now fairly well exhausted, except for some commentaries that may be written, will indeed be of Manichaean nature, and so this particular dispensation of the Gnosis may be brought to the attention of the public once more, probably within the next few years. To us and to our Gnostic tradition, of course, Mani has always been a very precious figure, and we know that without his dispensation of the Gnosis, and also the way in which his disciples and his church spread the Manichaean version of Gnostic teachings to so many places in the world, including to China and to India, the Gnostic teachings probably would not have survived. The late and great Mr. Manly Hall was wont to say that had it not been for the prophet Mani and the work that he has started, the entire esoteric tradition in the West would probably be non-existent, that it was such an important element. We need also to keep to mind in this respect something else, namely that as we now deal with an entire transmission of a Gnostic character, which is outside of the matrix, let's say, of the Najd Hammadi scriptures, or even of the codices that were discovered prior to Najd Hammadi, such as Pistis Sophia and so forth, an entirely separate Gnostic dispensation. We need to keep in mind that in the Gnosis, we are dealing really with a living tradition, not just a set of scriptures, as wonderful and interesting as they might be, and that this living tradition, like anything that is alive, had, let's say, various embodiments throughout history. While the Manichaean embodiment comes right at the heels of the principal Alexandrian and Syrian Gnostic developments, very, very shortly thereafter, it is still sort of a separate chapter. And that there were other separate chapters, such as that of the Bogomils and the Cathars later on. And perhaps in our own humble way, we ourselves, along with the French Gnostic Church of the last 100 years and its predecessors prior to that time, are another chapter. Scriptures are important, but scriptures do not make religion. I think this is where the Protestant tradition in its various embodiments and devolutions since Luther and Calvin increasingly has made a mistake. There are religions in the world today, and certainly there were others earlier on, that either did not have any scriptures for a long time, or don't have any now. Take, for instance, the ancient and really aboriginal religion of Japan, Shinto. Shinto didn't have any scriptures. It was purely a matter of oral tradition, teaching, and ritual. Then the Buddhists came across the ocean from Korea and China with their scriptures, because of course the Buddhists were very bookish people. They had many scriptures. And then the Shinto leaders stuck their heads together and said, "Oh my," or perhaps, "Oh ne." "What are we going to do? We don't have any holy books." So they sat down and wrote some. And that is how the Shinto holy books, the Yengi Shiki and some of these, came into existence. They wrote down what previously they held in their minds. So this is also true of the Gnosis. I well remember a little incident which has been immortalized in that great compendium of wisdom known as the Los Angeles Times, back about, I have a cutting of it somewhere, back about, I think, 1972, when John Dart, who since then became a principal religion writer of the Los Angeles Times, came to see me and presented a little interview. He asked me what our position was regarding the then just about to be published Nag-Samadhi scriptures. And I said, "Oh, well, we are very happy about it. But, you know, in essence, we are aware of these things already." And he said, "How can that be?" "Well, because the Gnostic tradition has been in existence. And there were other scriptures that were available to us already. And so the essential character of the Gnostic transmission is going to be enriched by this. But it is not going to be altered thereby." And he was taken aback by this, to him at least, seeming revelation. So it is in this sense that we have to remember that there are these various embodiments of Gnosis, because we are dealing here with something that has been in existence for a long time and that continues to move throughout history. And the essence of the tradition is always the same. And there are just really a few essential pillars of it. One of them being that within the human being lies dormant and alienated and lost, having wandered away from its original source, that abiding spark of the divine fire, the little embodiment of ultimate divinity, which has become separated from its source and which has the innate drive, the innate desire to reestablish contact with its source and to return to it. And that even as that longing aspiration grows forth from the human, and if we look at Mani's version of it, in a manner of speaking, actually in all of creation, because Mani, in one of the Manichaean scriptures, going back to the prophet himself, we have the beautiful expression, he says, "Jesus is still crucified in every tree." And he doesn't mean by that we ought to bow down in tree worship, as some would, but rather that in creation, both the biological and forms, and let's say in the mineral forms, even there, the lost sparks of the divine fire are present. And they, from there, they need to be awakened and liberated, which is a very different proposition from sort of bowing down before them and saying, oh, great Mother Nature, but rather, raise the stone and thou shalt find me, cleave the wood and I am there, which is from the Gospel of Thomas, a scripture incidentally which the Manichaeans apparently were aware of and used. So the sort of unsubtle mind would look at these kinds of statements and say, this declares the presence of the divinity in the stone and in the wood. Yes, but it also imposes us to do something. Raise the stone and cleave the wood or split the wood. What does that mean? Let me out. Let me out. Let me out. Right? And this is the underlying, absolutely essential feature of Gnosis, and it's always present in various ways. At the very time when the star of classical Gnosticism, as exemplified by such teachers as Valentinus, Bardesanes, Basilides, and Marcion and others, was declining, was setting in the Roman Empire, primarily as the result of the establishment of popularized self-styled Orthodox Christianity by the imperial power of Constantine and his successors. At that very time, the star of Mani rose in the east, literally east of the Roman Empire, primarily beginning in Persia, what is now called Iran, and the light of this star shone longer and over a larger part of the world, really, than any other light of the Gnosis. It was the carrier of the Gnostic tradition for well over 1,000 years. It's a fairly long time, especially when you are subject to constant persecutions. For this reason alone, it deserves the attention and the respect of those who are interested in the tradition at the present time. However, as we shall see, there are many more important reasons also. The life story of the prophet Mani has been told by me and by others elsewhere and before, and while it is certainly not without interest, and like the life stories of a lot of great teachers, it is a paradigm in many ways of the tradition itself. As we indicated in connection with Buddha, I will mention it only briefly at this point, and then certain salient features will appear in connection with the teachings. Just so we can place him once again historically, Mani was born, according to our calendar, on April the 25th, AD 215, so in the early part of the 3rd century. And we celebrate April the 15th as Mani Day. And as most of you are aware, that beautiful icon over there, painted by a priest of ours, who is also a fine painter, Father Jan Sæther of Norway, serves as our constant reminder of the great importance to us of Mani. He was born in a locale in a place called Boromia in Mesopotamia, which at the present time would be called Iraq. So if you can brave Saddam Hussein, you might want to go over there and take a look at it. I don't know. I don't know whether that would be all that advisable. And The just like there were certain key events in the life of Buddha, so were certain key events in the life of Mani. But they all had to do with one particular recurring strange experience. And this was the experience of his own divine or heavenly twin, his twin angel, as he sometimes referred to it. When Mani was 12 years old, the twin angel came to him and indicated to him that later on in his life he would have to do something very important. And then he, for 12 years, these are the so-called 12 lost years of Mani, because for one thing, one doesn't, after his age 12, one isn't entirely certain where he was, and it's also lost in the sense that the angel had gone away and wasn't with him. Then when he was 24 years old, the angel returned and announced that now was time for him to begin his public career. And then Mani indicated that the twin angel remained with him in the sense that he was in constant communication with him until his death, which occurred by way of the violent persecution of the then king of Persia, when in AD 277, on February the 26th, he died in prison, at which time the angel, visible even to some others according to some reports, came and took him with him and left. Gilles Quispel, the noted scholar of Gnosticism in Holland, in an essay that he wrote for a kind of an encyclopedic work, also said, if I can quote him more or less correctly, that Mani's faith was just like the faith of the Gnostics, was not based in theory, but was based in his own experience, which was dramatized and punctuated by the three great appearances in his life of the twin angel. That these were the hallmarks of his ongoing personal Gnostic experience. There are several things that we need to keep in mind about Mani. One of them is the role, the position that he occupied. He is generally called a prophet by scholars, although his followers, I don't think, use that term. His followers almost inevitably referred to him as the luminary, the light, because he was their light, and indicating that he was indeed their light that brought vision and clarity to their minds. He called himself quite often an apostle of Jesus Christ. And also, at some point, he identified himself as the Paraclete whom Jesus promised. To call him a prophet is, however, accurate, because he was a man who stood in a special relationship to the divine world and gave revelations concerning matters which were unknown to ordinary mortals. Also, we need to keep in mind that Mani moved, at least in throughout most of his life, except for his long journey to the east, to India, and probably parts of China. He moved among peoples who were of the prophetic tradition. For the Iranians or Persians, as well as the Jews, those peoples who were influenced by them were all respecters of the prophetic tradition. The Persians or Iranians by that time followed the prophet Zarathustra, a reformer and a reconstituting agent of the Persian religion, who brought a monotheistic structure to Persia. And of course, in the Jewish matrix, we had a large number of prophets. Now, you generally need to keep in mind that a prophet is different in terms of, not only in terms of his role, but in terms of his character. Let's say from a descent, or what the Hindus call an avatar. In fact, in some ways, Buddha, if transposed into a Western matrix, would probably qualify more as a figure like a prophet, because it was generally known and agreed that Buddha was born as a human being, that he was the flowering of the human race. And so the prophets are similarly the flowering of the human race, who reach up toward the divine. And then they are chosen by divinity to become the mouthpieces, the messengers of the divine, which is very different from from a figure like Jesus, or let's say in Hinduism like Krishna or Rama, who come from on high. They are embodiments of divinity who descend, so they are the descent of the divine light, while a prophet is the reaching out of the human light toward the divine, who then receives a certain response for this. And this is certainly true of Mani, although I think we can certainly find in the Manichaean scriptures passages which, at least in all likelihood, from what one can see, are attributed to Mani, where he speaks of his vivid memory as to where he originally came from, and he speaks of his knowledge of the heavenly realms and how he was present in the transcendental realm, along with the various heavenly beings and the great king of light. Now, the other important issue, or the other important role, is the statement on Mani's own part that he was an apostle of Jesus. Now, generally, when we sort of cling to biblical lore, then we are under the impression that Jesus had these 12 apostles whom he had chosen physically, and who all knew him personally, and who then survived him and carried on the work, that these are the apostles. But you know, even if you deal just with the canonical biblical material, you readily recognize that this is not entirely true, because there is one apostle who wasn't chosen that way. Who was that? That's the apostle Paul, or Saint Paul. Here is a man who is everywhere in the church is called an apostle, but he never knew Jesus. He probably hadn't even seen him physically. In fact, he was a Pharisee of strong convictions, who was very opposed to this fledgling heretical movement. But what happened then? What happened to him was what happens to the Gnostic. He didn't come across a book. He came across an experience. And that is, of course, the story of the road to or from Damascus, depending which scripture you take, and what happened to him there, wherein of which only sort of cryptic comments are made in his letters, but which are much more clearly explained in a scripture in the Nag Hammadi collection called the Apocalypse of Paul, where just like in the usual account, he falls, he sees someone on the road, and then he falls or jumps off his horse, and whom he sees on the road is a little child. The child signals to him, and then he gets down there, and the child takes him by the hand and leads him into the heavens, and then they move through the seven mansions of heavens and beyond. This is in the Apocalypse of Paul. And this is how he becomes an apostle, by way of his own experience. And the Gnostics, particularly Valentinus, who actually directly traced his lineage from St. Paul, his apostolic lineage, referred to Paul as the apostle, because they felt that he was the Gnostic apostle due to the fact that he became an apostle on the basis of his own inner Gnostic experience and not just being physically chosen. Apostleship, the acquisition of apostleship was certainly possible by other than the purely physical historical means. It is in this sense that Mani regarded himself as an apostle. It was generally assumed in a lot of books that the Manichaeans were not Christians. Well, they were not Christians of the kind that the people who proclaimed themselves Christians were. Yet Mani's statements in the Manichaean scriptures, both those that come, that trace back directly to him and to others, make almost constant references to Jesus. And I'm not going to read a lot of scripture this evening, although they are so sublimely beautiful, most of them, that that is probably what I really should have done, rather than prattle along myself. An example almost taken at random. This is the soul of the Manichaean devotee praying to God to be released and to be taken to God. And it's just a particular portion. Oh, my prayers and my fasts and my good deeds which I have perfected in thy name, Jesus, my light, this is the moment of my death when I have need of you. This is really a death prayer. Yoke for me speedily my soaring chariots and my horses, which are my holy fasts, my prayers to God, and my almsgivings. Take me swiftly into the land of those of the glory. O mighty one, crown me, take me on thy wings, O eagle, and fly with me to the skies. Put my white robe upon me, take me in as a gift to thy father. So he is called the eagle, who takes you to the heavens. A metaphor that has been certainly used by others, including Saint Francis, who referred to God as the eagle who was carrying him aloft, and he knew not where, but he was sailing in the talons of the divine eagle. And it appears, of course, in other sources as well. So the respect and the recognition of Jesus as a particularly important figure of this transmission, as the Messiah, was certainly present in the Manichaean mythos. However, by that time, of course, Jesus was long gone, about 250 years or so, depending on the particular chronology. And now Mani was the luminary, the light, who carried the same effort forward that Jesus had begun. Now the other issue that I think needs to be brought up is really the issue of the of the twin angel, which I mentioned already. I also noted that Professor Crispell, with his strong psychological orientation owing to the fact that he was closely associated with C.G. Jung, Crispell even pointed out that the so-called dualism of Mani is also rooted in Mani's personal experience with his twin angel, and that Crispell wrote, yes, there is a real dualism, but you know what it is? It's the duality dichotomy between the human ego, the human terrestrial personality, and the transcendental being, which is the divine angel, the angelic part of the human. So he looked upon the, it's always called twin, he looked upon Mani's twin angel as Mani's higher self. It's become a trite word, you know. Whenever someone wants to appeal to his better qualities, he can call it his higher self. But there is something much, much more profound meant here, that there is a dichotomy between these two. And who can deny it? How often in our lives, how regrettably, terribly, awfully often, do we act out of motives of our human personality? And how very, very seldom, how regrettably and awfully seldom does this something else, something profound, something wise, impersonal and still at the same time individual, manifest and comes through. If it happens a few times in our lives that we can really be aware of that, and I really was inspired by, I was acting out of a center of myself that is essentially different from the one that ordinarily works within me. If that happens a few times in our lives, we can really reckon ourselves fortunate. It's that duality within the human, so Crispell pointed out, and I think he has a very important point, that is the experiential core of the so-called dualism of Mani, and for that matter of other Gnostics. So again, it's something that is experienced, that the wisdom, the power, the glory of our indwelling divinity is locked up in something else. And that these two are coexisting in a curious kind of a condition. And it's not just the body. This is not it would be a grave mistake, and I think a terrible injustice a great injustice is done to all Gnostics, including Mani and his followers, by assuming that we are dealing with just a mind-body or a soul-body duality. Mind or soul in themselves, psyche, you know, are part of the lower personality also. They may be different from the body, but that's not really according to the Gnostic where it's at. Your mind, your psyche, as that's after all the Greek word for soul, are just as, how should I put it, enfeebled and contaminated by the fault in this universe as your body. They last a little bit longer. They can do things that your body can't do, but then your body can do things that your mind cannot do either, you know. You might say the body, there goes the body dies, and this immaterial complex that we refer to as soul, or anima or psyche is still there and goes on. This is incidentally to which a lot of people, including the Jews and the Romans and the Greeks, sort of referred to as the shade. The Romans called it the lemur. And it's after this lemur that that little long-tailed monkey was named, you know, the lemur monkey. And there is one, but because it's a non-physical remnant of the human being that sort of drifts around and then goes to Hades or Sheol, it doesn't have the fire, it doesn't have the spiritual core of a real being. It's shade, you know. Here was always the question: who are you? That cannot be answered in any book. Who are you? If you are identified with the body, if you think you are the body, then you die with the body. If you are identified with the shade, then you drift around as the shade, and then there isn't much left. But if you have made contact with the third, the twin, the Ogoides, as the Greeks have called it, the shining being, then with that shining being you will live forever and you will join the heavenly kingdom of the gods. And to a large extent it's up to you. So where is your consciousness? You see? People don't like to hear this. I don't think maybe some of you like to hear it from that. Why? Because it's so much nicer to say, I am immortal. See? I am going to go on forever. What we mean by that, of course, is pretty much the way I am now, maybe minus the body, with all of my unconsciousness, with all of my stupidity and cupidity, with all of my faults. Why? Because that's what I identify with. If none of these are going to be there, then what is there of me? We have this assumption of automatic immortality. But you know, really very few people had that. In ancient Egypt, in ancient China, in a lot of places. Now this may be exaggerated too, but there is a point there that we miss in our Western traditions. And that's the concept of earned immortality. If you don't do something about it, you are not going to be immortal. So go ahead and do something about it, you know. Carl Jung was at a, our modern Gnostic teacher, was at some kind of a big sports event. I would think it was probably a soccer game, because that's what is so popular in Europe. And there were thousands of people there, and you know how people get at the sports event, lots of excitement, lots of noise. And he looked at his friend who was with him and pointed at the crowd and said, look at them all, look at them all, look at them all. And they all want to be immortal. That was his comment. Here are these you know, people caught up in this kind of lowly stupidity and manifesting a tremendous amount of unconsciousness. And if you don't know European soccer fans, then you don't know what unconsciousness is. I mean, you know, it's really a big one. They assume and that they are immortal. The task, and that is really the Gnostic task. There is the soma, or the the hiletic body, there is the psychic body, and then there is the real you, which, however, now you don't know as the real you. And it's so different, it's so transcendent, it's so glorious, that to the human ego it appears like an angel. And that's the one that you have to make contact with. When you are cooperating with it, and are increasingly in a condition of union with it, then you are directed from the right place. Then you are directed from within outwards rather than from outside toward the inside. But of course that takes some doing. Not all of us have the privilege of at the age of 12 that angel appearing to us and then making friends with us and going on from there. But somehow this is the beginning of an entire world view, that when we come to recognize this dichotomy, that a very angelic being is hidden, deeply connected with, but still very much separated from our physical and psychic selfhood, then this becomes a paradigm for everything that goes on in the world, and we begin to see that a similar condition exists elsewhere. Now, let me move from that to some of the other teachings of Mani, which, however, are very much related. In an awful lot of respects, the essential teachings of Mani are, I would say, identical with those of Valentinus and the other Gnostic teachers. There isn't that much difference, but there's one teaching that is really an addition. And this has to do with the reason, let us say, the underlying raison d'etre of our present existential condition. I mentioned last time in connection with Buddha that Buddha did not feel that it was important for his purposes, to the people that he was speaking to account for their condition. He just said, look, you are here and you are suffering, every last one of you. You are all miserable. He didn't say you are miserable sinners. He left that to the preachers. You know. He just said you are miserable. You are miserable because you are in misery. And the question is, it wouldn't have to be that way. You could get out of this, but you have to work at it. And I can't just do it for you. I can show you certain things. I can show you the way. And then he gave them the Noble Eightfold Path and so forth, which are his plan, where how to work our way out of that suffering and out of that misery. But he never really told people how they got into that misery. And don't think that they didn't ask him. But if you are a bunch of Hindus in India, they'll ask you everything. They'll ask you so many questions that you can perish if you don't protect yourself. So maybe it was because the people have terribly active minds, you know. At one time, I was in the unenviable position of having two friends around him here, one of whom was from India, although he was a Pakistani, but his ancestors came from Bombay. And the other friend here was a Greek from Athens, our good friend Elias. And let me tell you, between those two, they kept me going. If I had a conversation with one, it would last 5 or 6 hours. Conversation with the other one, it would last the same. So they are very... They are very loquacious people with terribly powerful minds, and they ask all kinds of questions. And they ask Buddha questions of that sort, but that doesn't mean that he answered it. And he answered in ways such as this. He said, look, if your house is on fire, what is the reasonable thing to do? To go and put out the fire, or to start asking questions how the fire came to be? By the time you find out how the fire started, your house burned down. So put out the fire. Or you are shot by an arrow and you are in a bad way because of that. You have to extricate the arrow from your body and not first ask all kinds of questions as to who shot the arrow. Going from Buddha to the classical ancient Gnostics, except for a rather brief and not terribly involved mythological story now and then, such as the story of the Demiurge coming forth from Sophia and then creating the world, and the Demiurge not being perfect anymore, not being very smart anymore, therefore creating an imperfect world. Really, the ancient Gnostics did not give all that great, all that long, all that complex an explanation of the origin of our present condition and of the origin of evil either. They concentrated also much more on the path out than on the explanation how we got here, although I dare say there is more of an explanation there than in most of conventional mainstream religiosity. Mani, however, went further. And Mani gave an explanation which is which goes further back and is more complex than almost any other that we know. I'll give you a little glimpse of that. In the very beginning, said Mani, long before heaven and earth and everything contained therein that we know here came into being, there was a realm of light, boundless light. In it dwelt the ultimate God, the Father of greatness, who with his being, his power, his light, and his wisdom is also known as the four-faced God. This infinite and ineffable beneficent Godhead reigned for countless eons in the realm of boundless light in tranquility and peace. Then, from an outer, inscrutable and terrible realm of darkness, there arose a terrible dark king who was determined to invade the realm of light. The terrible king and his realm were heavy, coarse, unwieldy, inflexible, and for this reason the prophet Mani gave them sometime the name that is usually translated matter or materiality, but it is doubtful that he meant the kind of matter that we are dealing with here. What the myth tells us is that the heavenly realm of boundless light was attacked, invaded and violated by a dark external force that lusted after the light. A Gnostic motif that we find in the story of Sophia and elsewhere, because what there are all kinds of dark, chaotic beings in the chaos, all sorts of archons and demons and so forth. What they see in Sophia is the light. They want the light. They want to steal her light. They're always after her to take her light away, because that's one thing that they don't have. The Dark Lord's kingdom is characterized by Mani as in itself disorderly, disharmonious, and discontinuous, and that with its own turbulent restlessness it passed beyond its own boundaries and came to see the light, having acquired a passion for something better than itself. It pressed on to mingle with the light and to possess it. So took place an invasion of the light world by the host of this dark lord, a veritable rape of the light by the darkness. And thus the integrity of the realm of light was broken, and the powers of light were well nigh helpless in their defense against this dark invasion. Now the myth continues. It would seem that after the initial violation of the heavenly integrity, things could not remain their peaceful selves. The attack was repelled. But the God of Light descended now to send a portion of himself out into the realm outside of the light to track and chase the evildoer down and to neutralize him so that it wouldn't happen anymore. The invading forces were still nearby, and they had to be attacked at that time. And so a portion of the Godhead, that is called the primal man, the Anthropos, which occurs in all kinds of Gnostic stories. You know, you may recall the how the creation of the human being takes place in some of the Nag Hammadi scriptures. The archons look up and they see the Anthropos in the heavens, or they see the reflection of the Anthropos in a body of water. And this is the heavenly archetype, the heavenly man. And then they make a shape in the semblance of that, and that becomes the original Adam, the golem, the robot who is crawling on his belly and cannot move, and then Sophia has to put light into him. So this is again this figure, an archetypal figure of celestial humanity, and this the primal man, Mani sometimes just refers to him as the spirit. And now we have the statement of this the primal man and his hosts going forth, and now something happens. As a stratagem, this is how it is represented in the Manichaean scriptures, as a stratagem of capturing and defeating this darkness. In the course of the battle, the hosts of the primal man mingle with the darkness. And now, in some of the scriptures, it would seem they get captured. According to others, they sacrifice themselves. In order to accomplish the defeat, they themselves have to be captured. They sacrifice themselves and are now captured by the darkness. In some of the scriptures, it's interpreted as a kind of a defeat. According to others, a sacrifice. And as the result of this, the primal man, this great heavenly man, like the Adam Kadmon of Kabbalistic lore, has been scattered, dismembered. His essence is now commingled with the darkness. So we have here now, this is the second catastrophe, the first being the initial attack on the heavenly kingdom. First, the integrity of heaven is breached, and now the warrior who descended into the abyss to go after the darkness is there captured, and his essence of light is mingled with darkness. The great existential predicament is presented to us in this fashion. Even before the creation of the material universe as we know it, therefore, the light of God has been captured and imprisoned, and moreover in such a manner that much of the divine life essence is seemingly helplessly intermingled with darkness. The Godhead itself in its manifest aspect is now captive, a suffering, pathetic God who is hung up on the cross of darkness, helpless and agonizing. And this is where the expressions come from, which we find in the Manichaean scriptures, that Jesus is hung up on every tree. So what is the condition then? The existential condition within which we find ourselves is one wherein we, as our consciousness awakens, begin to see reciprocity, the transgressivity between ourselves, our own condition, and the condition of the universe within which we live. Everywhere the light is captive. Everywhere the divine is scattered and is calling out for redemption. And those who awaken to this task and to this consciousness become the helpers, become the redeemers of the light in the world. So our task is a dual one, by helping to liberate the light within ourselves. And this, of course, we are greatly stimulated and inspired by the luminaries, by the messengers such as Mani and before him Jesus, because they are the ones who awaken us and who straighten us out and show us what needs to be done. But as our own light begins to awaken, with that we can address ourselves in various ways to the awakening and to the liberating of the light around us. The more there are who in whom the light now burns brightly, the more the light awakens everywhere around them and also reaches out to be taken up to its original source. And this is where Mani and his followers employed all kinds of wonderful metaphors, but within the metaphors there was a sort of a mysterious reality that I think is of a more than symbolic nature. And the two terms for it were the column of light and the ship of light. It appears again and again. Both of these mean that a vehicle, or maybe vehicles, have been created. And in their creation, the work of people, messengers like Jesus and Mani, played a great role. Vehicles have been created, and through these vehicles, the light now has the ability to gather and to go to its source. And Mani used the symbol, the metaphor of the moon. And ever since I read that, I can never look at the moon in any one of its phases without remembering that. And he said, the moon is the ship of light, and this was not meant physically. And when the new moon is there, you can see that the ship, front and back, kind of like a Venetian gondola, very thin. But then it gets bigger and bigger, because now it is being loaded, it is being filled up with light. And by the time it is completely filled up with light, the full moon, then it goes and unloads its load in heaven, and then comes back again. But that is just an image to keep in mind. So the vehicle is here gathering the light. And in this task, the Manichaeans were advised to be sort of little light gatherers, little saviors themselves, right down to the point. I don't know whether this may have had something to do that quite a powerful Manichaean movement was started in China, and the Chinese had ideas along this line, not quite the same, but along this line for a long time. That, for instance, there are certain substances, certain fruits, and certain foods, which contain more light than others. And one of the There probably were more, but one of the statements that survives in one of the scriptures, that melons contain more light than other fruit, and that the Manichaeans were enjoyed to eat melons because by taking these into themselves, the light within the fruit would join the ship of light and go home. I'm sure that there were others, I know one smiles at this, but once again, I think in it we can discern a principle that our life in this world, even our eating and drinking, can have a sacramental aspect, that once the light rises within us, we can transform and liberate into the greater life what we take into ourselves. And if you extend that from eating, from the body, let's say you extend that to the realm of the mind, then whatever we gather into our psyche, whatever we experience with the intensity of our nature, can also be liberated. So we become liberators of the light around us. Very, let's say, it's a more intense and perhaps in some ways more poetic, and in certain respects perhaps even more practical application of the principle of gnosis than we see earlier, because here we have a direct injunction given to the human to be a co-liberator and a co-savior, and to keep gathering the light while he is here. Very unusual, and at the same time, I think, having raised the Gnostic task, the Gnostic impulse, to a greater level of intensity than hitherto has been the case. And we need to keep in mind that the Manichaean Gnostic movement really was the only Gnostic movement up to that time that actually had a very large following and became a world religion, because it existed both in the Mediterranean matrix and in Asia. And as such, it was perhaps the only instance in the history of the Gnostic movements where the Gnostic tradition was more than a minority movement. Of course, it had its vicissitudes. Mani himself was martyred in Persia. The Manichaeans were persecuted in Persia after they attained an initial prominence. But in many other places, they became very important, including in certain parts of China, where Manichaean cave paintings and Manichaean scriptures are China and Turkestan are being discovered to the present time. So obviously there was an appeal there that had the capacity to penetrate much more to the popular level than some of the other much more philosophical and much more restrained statements of the Gnostic tradition. Let me give you an idea, more or less in conclusion, from the Manichaean scriptures, which are filled with such sublime poetic beauty, of really this intentionality that I was just going to convey. Here too, we have the statement, let's say, of the Manichaean devotee who is on his way to the light and who has fulfilled the purpose. I have found the ships. The ships, which are like the sun and the moon, they have transported me to the heavenly city. I have found the haven. The haven is the teaching of the luminary. I have set my foot on the path, and the path is the gnosis of God. Ferry me to the sun and moon, O ferry boat of light, that hovers over these three realms. Disperse the dark cloud that is before my eyes, that I may be able to cross rejoicing to thine honored dwellings. I have contrived to see thy light, so I have no concern with the darkness. Therefore let no one weep for me. See, the gates of the light have opened to me. I rejoice as I ascend to my Father, with whom I have conquered in the land of darkness. O my great King, transport me to the city of the angel gods. Take me into the homes of joys, for I am thine, and count into my hand the reward of my many contests. I rejoice for eternity of eternities. I worship thee, O Father of the lights, and I bless you, O aeons of joy, and my brothers and sisters from whom I have been far away and have found again once more in the greater realm. I have become a holy bride in the peaceful bright chamber of the light. I have received the gifts of victory. No rendering in prose can come close to the ecstatic vision that is present in the Manichaean scriptures. And perhaps if there is any central keynote, it is that the awakening of that longing for one's own true place, one's own true estate, the condition from whence we have come, and then the determination to serve that and to assist all the scattered and imprisoned light that one comes in contact with in this world to similarly awaken and to also rise to its own true being, to its own true estate. A powerful and feeling-toned statement of the Gnosis, which was extremely successful and which really in many ways continued into later period. And while this is a theory that is not now generally accepted, I am still convinced, and my conviction grew when I was physically present in those areas, that the Cathars of the Languedoc definitely had Manichaean inspiration, that the teachings and the inspiration of the prophet Mani came back from Asia and from the Middle East and was at least an important part of that revival of the Gnosis. And while I would be loath to make personal statements to that effect, but I can tell you, small and select company, that without the inspiration that in various ways, and I will not own up to them in detail, that I have received from Mani for many decades, I would not have been able to do this little Gnostic work that I did either. So I really feel his presence and the presence of that wonderful dispensation even in our midst here today, and I look forward to the time when the Manichaean scriptures will once again come forward in greater profusion, as I mentioned before. One book has already been published, Gnosis on the Silk Road, by a trade publisher just a few years ago. It's all filled with Manichaean scriptures, and more will be coming, and I think that another keynote of the Gnosis will be added to what the Nag Hammadi scriptures have really started, and it will be a very beautiful one, and one that will carry the Gnostic impulse to greater heights yet, because somehow the treasure was there, but I think Mani gave the wings to the treasure. And as he said of Jesus, that Jesus came And then he went to Palestine, and he went in the land and he looked for the stones. Strange statement. He said that he went to the seashore and then he gathered the pearls. And the interpreter statement is that the stones are the hard encasement within which the lion dwells. But perhaps there was also another meeting. But he went and found the jewels that are scattered in this world, and he brought them back to the treasure house. And Mani, in his, said that in his own humble way, that is what he was doing as well. And maybe, given some more opportunities, and with God's grace some more time, maybe that is what we shall do also. More stones, more pearls, more jewels to be returned to the treasury. May it be so. Thank you very much.